All right. You are listening to The Real World on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. This is The Real World, which is UBC Film Society's radio segment where we talk about all things film related. And we have some very special guests today. Well, I'll start off. I'm Emma. You all know me. This is
Lily.
We've also got two special guests. We've got
Jasmine
and
Fernando.
Yay!
The rolled
four people in the studio. We're so happy. But not only do we host this radio show, we also put on various screenings throughout the week. There's lots more movie-related events. Follow our Instagram at UBC Film Society to stay updated on everything that's going on with the club. And if you're interested, join us this Thursday in the Performance Theater for Princess Mononoke at 6 and Tropical Malady at 8. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about queer films. But before that, we're going to get some ads going. So we will see you guys in a moment.
I can't wait to sit by myself at the beach and look at my phone. Huh? What's that?
Man, what are you doing? Get over here and come jam.
Wow, what a lovely assortment of musicians. What are you guys doing?
This is E-Studio. We come together and build connections over music. No musical experience needed. Just come socialize and build your confidence playing music if that's your thing.
Wow, this is so awesome. Now I have a real-life connections with Vancouver's international community of musicians and creatives. Thank you, E-Studio. E-Studio is an international jam group where we celebrate music from all around the world and play together. Follow us on Instagram at estudio.cafe. estudio.cafe.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host John P for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyberweb? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives. News, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
All right, and we are back. So, today's topic, as we said, is queer films. We're going to be talking about 4 films today. We've got Jennifer's Body, we have Pink Flamingos, Paris is Burning, and Tropical Malady, which is showing Thursday if you want to see it for yourself. So, starting off, we're going to be beginning with Jennifer's Body, which is a 2009 American comedy directed by Karen Kusama, starring Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried, and following Jennifer, a cheerleader who is possessed by a demon, and her best friend Needy that must try and stop her carnage. So, thoughts on Jennifer's Body?
Okay, I can go first. Well, do we want to talk about very quickly about why we chose queer cinema?
Yes, tell us, Jasmine.
Well, okay, fine. The reason is not flattering to you, by the way. I asked Fernando, what theme do you want to do? He said, I don't have much time to watch movies. And I was like, all right, queer cinema it is. You're the expert.
Yeah. We also went to the Queer Film Festival. Shout out to them.
Shout out Queer Film Festival.
Yeah. Hell it was yeah. This past 2 weeks in Vancouver. Some good films. Shout outs to Layla. Mm-hmm. Layla was really good. It's about a drag queen, British Palestinian, really good. So once it finally comes out in theaters, please go watch Layla. Ooh. That's my ad for Layla.
Not paid.
Not paid at all.
Okay, Jennifer's Body. So me and Fernando watched it over the weekend for the first time. It was both of our first times watching. And I personally loved it. I like this idea of how it's kind of had this renaissance of, like, a movie that's too ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Like, when it came out, everybody was like, man, this movie sucks. And Megan Fox sucks at acting. And I watched and I was like, what are people talking about? First of all, she's a great actress. She's beautiful. She's beautiful. And it is, like, it's so fun. It's so girly. It's literally a movie made for women. But targeted towards men, or marketed towards men, and such is life, you know.
It's really tragic it got released in, like, 2009, not today, because this would have, like, killed,
done numbers.
Like, even, like, when, I know, like, Lisa Frankenstein, which is not at all, like, you know, the same, but, like, the similar sort of, like, girl just going crazy thing, that was just, like, such an immediate, like, hit for me. That was like, oh, my God, I wish Jennifer's Body could have had this reception, like, the first time it came out, because it deserves it. It is, like, so well done.
Written by the same person.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Diablo Cody.
Really?
Yeah. Because they wrote this right off of Juno as well, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Coming, like, from Juno to Jennifer's Body to then, like, Lisa Frankenstein now. What filmography. Aspire to be like Diablo. I think, like, it's really interesting, like, looking at this film through a queer lens, because it's not one of those movies, I feel like, that's, like, queer-coded. Like, it is, like, one step away from just being explicitly queer. Like, I was watching it, and I was like, oh, I thought this was going to be a lot more, like, implicit than it actually was. It was very, like, explicitly gay, which I think is so fun to have, like, pre-2010.
Love them lesbians.
Yeah.
Love them. They're great. And, I mean, I like the genre of horror and comedy, and the subversion of the slasher, how it's not a man killing a bunch of women as, you know, Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger. Well, they're kind of all gay icons, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
For different reasons. But Jennifer is a queer icon because she just kills a bunch of men.
Yeah.
And we love that. Yeah. It's like our own frustrations against men. No offense.
It's okay. I had a similar reaction to Emma because I thought it, like, queer audiences just gravitated towards it in the same sense that they gravitate towards horror in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I was surprised at how explicitly queer it is.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It's 2009. Good year. Amanda Seyfried, she had just done Mamma Mia. Mamma Mia reference. Mamma Mia is 2008, I believe.
That's crazy. Fresh off Mamma Mia to this.
Yeah. So, queer icon.
Yeah. I didn't know, like, Chris Pratt was in this, though. Like, that was such a little surprise.
That was a jump scare, yeah.
I was so scared.
Wait, him, when is he in it again?
Oh, God, it's, like,
at the bar.
Yeah, at the bar. He plays just this, like, cadet. Like, oh, my God, this sleazy little cadet. And he shows up, and it's like, oh, my God, that's entirely Chris Pratt. And, like, him and, like, J.K. Simmons is also in this.
Oh, my God.
Just casually as, like, a teacher. Yeah.
So, like, random.
The cast is kind of stacked for some reason. But I think, yeah, this movie is just so 2009. Like, I love, like, all the outfits, especially all of Jennifer's outfits. Like, every single thing she puts on, it's like, yeah, need this in my closet immediately.
Mm-hmm.
That little, like, emo kid running around. Like, I was watching, I'm like, yeah, I want every single piece of wardrobe that he's wearing. Mm.
Yeah, well, I really liked it as well. I saw it last year, so I'm like not on my freshest memories of it, but just like reflecting on it, I was kind of fresh out of taking FIST 100 and learning about the horror genre and a lot about how like female sexuality and the role of female sexuality in horror and like scary films. And so I was kind of like at the beginning, maybe like thinking about this side of where it might have flopped a little bit when it first came out, of just kind of taking female sexuality and making it into like this deviant, like villainous character. But I think what Jennifer's Body does that kind of subverts like that so often taken pathway with female sexuality in horror is like it gives voice to like the deviant woman who has been represented in film and like so much dominant culture time and time again as like the monster who's like exploring their sexuality but in this like horrible, evil, like malicious way. But then it's like giving voice to them as victims and people who have like survived something, like survived violation, and it kind of like goes back. And that's what I like about the structure of it as well, of like it gives you the whole, like so much of the movie of Jennifer kind of like being this villain. And then it loops back at that point of like, what was the core, like what turned her into this possessed person, like later on, which I had forgotten that that happened so much later on, but I'm really glad that it did, because it like gives you room to kind of be like, oh my gosh, here we go again. Like this horrible, like woman covered in blood, like how disgusting. And then it loops back and it's like, how did she get here? And what happened, which is also like the funniest, a really horrible scene actually of how she gets possessed, but also has some great one-liners as well with Adam Brody. I think he was so awesome and horrible. Yeah. But yeah.
Oh yeah. Like I know the directors talked a lot about kind of wanting to pay tribute to like horror conventions, but also like flipping them on their head, which I think she does like really well.
Yeah, I love that. Because it's like some iconic tropes. Like we've got her covered in blood, which is a great like icon of like the female in horror. And it's just like she looks amazing as well.
The prom dress.
Yeah, incredible. The prom dress, like just such iconic horror things that you love to see. But then it's also like complete satire of like what the male gaze is often in horror, like and how it sees women.
It's like, I can't believe this came out 2009 though. Like that seems like just the absolute worst moment for something like this to come out. Like the world was not ready for Jennifer's Body. Like I know, like I read so many reviews from the time, like of people calling it like Twilight for boys, which is like it's absolutely not.
Like, what? Really?
Like, yeah. Like I think there's like, oh, you know, like the sexy vampire sort of trope, but it's you know, people have like pointed out like rightfully so, there is no like Bella figure, like there's no male equivalent for Bella in Jennifer's Body, which does like also kind of help reinforce like the queer themes.
That's the thing. Like also so. Like, the men are completely pushed to the side of this movie. Like, all of the male figures, at least, well, like, I was trying to think about them of, like, Needy's boyfriend is just kind of doesn't really believe it, kind of swept to the side, really kind of confused, can't wrap his head around most things that are happening. So I feel like they just don't play an active role in it at all. And that's what also kind of subverted some expectations for this is female-centered, like, at its core, not just to represent something that's bloody and disgusting.
Yeah.
But just in the sense that the men are irrelevant.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting, like, how secondary they are. Like, it feels like it's so extreme. Like, I'm, like, sitting thinking it's, like, even though the boyfriend is in so much of the movie, like, he really just doesn't matter in the overall plot. Like, you're sitting watching, you're like, yeah, this guy has no power, like, in the overall storyline. Even though, like, you know, he doesn't really like Jennifer. It's like, it doesn't matter to Needy. Like, it is all about Jennifer in a way. Like, he's just there. He's like an ornament, basically, in the movie. Which, you know, maybe that's how it should be.
It's true. Yeah.
Bring back men just as secondary characters.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the true romance, I mean, Amanda in the movie, or Needy, you know, she has a boyfriend. Yeah. But, you know, ultimately, who cares? The real romance is between her and Jennifer, and it's like weirdly suppressed, but it comes out in very violent ways. But then they also have like lots of intimate moments together, like when Jennifer comes back and tells Needy like what happened to her, and they were like kissing on the bed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically a girl sleepover. And the way that she kills Jennifer at the end, and they're like up in the air and like twisting. Yeah, that's like intercourse for women. It's just that complicated.
Yeah, that's just what happens, you know? Yeah. How it is.
Totally. I love that you bring that up, because like how complicated their relationship is also like another thing that the men in this movie could never wrap their head around, like the complexities of a female friendship, romance, anything like that. I just love the intricacies of their relationship. Like even people at school don't understand, like, how could you just be friends? And there's like some obviously like intentional homophobic comments about that, of just like saying that obviously, oh, Needy, like you're definitely in love with her, like she would never be friends with you, and all of those things that people are saying at school. But mostly just people can't understand their relationship.
Yeah. Like the nuances of it. It's like, it is very much like, you know, those like obsessive like female friendships you have in like middle school or high school, and you look back and it's like, oh, that was definitely like queer. Like that was there was something more there than just like best friends. I think, yeah, it really like captures this time, I think, like for most queer women in their lives in like high school, where it's like everything is kind of a nightmare. You're trying to figure everything out, and also your best friend is like suddenly like really hot, and like you just want to spend time with her, like, all this sort of thing. I feel like it's like, it's just, God, it's such a fun movie. I love this movie. I can't believe it took me this long to see it, because it was like the first time I'd ever watched it.
Yeah, it's like, oh no, my that's God. So awesome. I'm so glad that it like has found its audience of people that it's resonating with us after like its initial release, like being received. I can't believe it's taken you guys this long to have watched it. Are you glad? Are you
how did his hands up.
How did you guys pick it then to talk about today?
How did we pick it?
Well,
there doesn't have to be like a major reason.
We needed a lesbian movie. We need a female identifying queer love, and we wanted something a bit more commercial. We have some not very commercial films on here, and Jennifer's Body is fun. We are also picking between that and The Handmaiden, like the Korean Park Chan-wook movie, but we were with a bunch of friends and we're like, let's watch Jennifer's Body, it's more fun to watch. That's kind of how we chose it.
Yeah, also covers the queer obsession with horror. I don't know what it is, but
there you go.
Yeah. We love horror.
No, that's so true. I think this would be a good beer garden movie. Have we done that?
We have, yeah.
Okay. It's
all been done.
There. It's all been done. Okay, well, we could run it back.
You should, yeah.
Yeah.
Jennifer's Body, part two, the beer garden. Yeah.
There's a sequel, I think, coming
really?
Out.
Really? Oh, my God.
What?
Mm-hmm.
With who?
With Megan.
What?
No. Huge day for gay people.
This could be totally fake news. I think I saw it.
We do no fact checking on the real world ever.
What I am just saying stuff
is true all the time. And everyone who listens should trust us unequivocally. Don't do your own research.
There's only Reddit. There's only Reddit to this fact.
Oh, frick.
Diablo Cody exposed. Wants Jennifer's Body sequel 15 years after being humiliated by Original's box office bomb.
So there's a chance.
There's a chance. So it's happening, is what Reddit is
coming
trying to
next
tell
next week.
Confirmed, yeah.
Megan's in, she's in the contract.
She's en route to set as we speak. Gosh, but yeah, that's Jennifer's Body. I think we're going to play a song from that, from Panic at the Disco.
Yes.
Just the epitome of early 2000s, like, emo trash. Let's hit it. This is New Perspective, Panic at the Disco.
Smile as I respire, because I know they'll never win. There's a your face, and I'll admire your expensive taste. And who cares, divine intervention, I wanna be praised from a new perspective. But leaving now would be a good idea, so catch me up on getting out of here. You come along because I love your face, and I'll admire your expensive taste. And who cares, divine intervention, I wanna be praised from a new perspective. But getting now would be a good idea, so catch me up, I'm getting out of here. It's not fair, just let me perfect it. Don't wanna live a life that is comprehensive, cause seeing clear would be a bad idea. Now catch me up, I'm getting out of here. Catch me up, I'm getting out of here.
All right, and that was New Perspective by Panic at the Disco. You know, love to hear it. Love to see it. But that was Jennifer's Body. Now we are moving on to Paris is Burning, which is a 1990 documentary directed by Jenny Livingston following the ballroom scene in New York. So, Paris is Burning. This is, God, I think I've only seen this once, but I watched it in like two halves, and I really wish that I like finished it the first time instead of like waiting so long in between, because it was like half a year before I like got around to finishing this movie.
And half a year.
Yeah.
That's really funny. That happens ever so often. Like,
yeah. I don't know what happens. Like, I started for a class and it was like the discussion was passed. I was like, okay, I guess I won't finish it. And I did. And I was like, oh my God, I've been missing out. Like, this is crazy. I should have finished this the first time. Yeah. What do you guys think about Paris is Burning?
Paris is Burning. Controversial film. I personally love it.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the controversy.
We're not going to talk about the
controversy? We are going to talk about the controversy. I think it's one of the most important queer films ever. Like, yeah. That's just a statement that I'm confident saying. It's the film so full of joy, so full of vibrant personalities. Their voices shine so bright. Yeah, there's some sadness in it at the end, especially considering the controversial aspects of the film, considering how the film is mostly an ethnographic film that captures the drag scene as a fading art, as something that's going extinct because of AIDS. And Jenny Livingston's voice is partly, well, not partly, it's fully guilty of that. but still the voices are so present. Everyone in the film is so full of joy. It's incredible. So many good dance numbers, so many good dresses. Peppola Beja in that gold dress. God. She changed the world.
Okay. Good statement to end on that. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to say about this movie, the influence it had on people's like acknowledgement and knowledge of drag culture. I mean, obviously, the elephant in the room is Drag Race, right? Which really kind of propelled it to the mainstream. But I mean, this was just, it's this peering into a very intimate space that's pretty, you know, has its own lexicon. They throughout the movie, they talk about different slang, applications of slang. It's all filmed within, you know, this, like, the ballroom itself is quite small community, but very tight. And I guess that's kind of, you bring in the controversy, is it's a bit of voyeuristic pleasures of peering into a space that you're kind of not invited into. You don't really have permission to look at. But I think, you know, I agree. I love this movie. It makes me very emotional. I cried the first time I saw it in class with Fernando 2 years ago. Good times. I think its influence on our knowledge and perception was just so monumental.
Yeah, I think it is, like, really, like, just, I feel like how much, like, joy there is in it is just so, like, especially when you consider, like, the context of the time of, like, the AIDS crisis and that sort of thing. Like, there is just, like, I feel like there's queerness, like, inherent in the act of just going out and celebrating in these, like, times of uncertainty instead of, like, hunkering down and hiding, like, kind of, like, living in fear, like, continuing to go out and to celebrate in this way. It's just, like, it's such a beautiful film to be able to see and to, like, have, just even as, like, an object of this, like, historic time period. I think to have this, like, this time preserved forever in this little, like, 90-minute film. Like, you see so much of all these, like, different people's, like, personalities and, like, just hearing their aspirations and their goals and, like, you know, now being able to, like, reflect back and, like, see, like, where everyone ended up. It really is, like, the whole thing is just so bittersweet, I feel like. But, yeah, no, it's just so, such a monumental documentary. And, I think, yeah, this is, like, a documentary, like, I would recommend to, like, everyone to go see. It's so good.
Oh, I forgot to add it to my, I made, like, this list on Letterboxd called Forcing Myself to Watch More Documentaries. And now I can put it in because I'm trying to watch more. I feel like I'm never watching enough.
Oh, yeah, not me neither.
Now I'll go around recommending it too, just like you, Emma. I loved it. I just watched it. Yeah. I feel like for me, like, I just learned so much because I didn't really know a lot about it at all. And yeah, I want to talk more about the controversy and, like, what your guys' understandings are of that, because I didn't know about anything related to, like, the ethics of making of the doc before I went into watching it. And when I watched it, the gift that I felt that a lot of the people in the film, like, gave us was the same gift that they felt in the ballroom of, like, inclusivity. Like, I really felt, like, getting to be in their rooms, and you have these, like, really intimate close-up shots of, like, just an angle right over their shoulder, and you can just see so much of them, and you hear them so clearly of what they're experiencing when they're telling their stories and, like, what their experience has been, like, going to the balls and stuff. I felt very included, and I think that was something that helped me, like, learn a lot from it. I don't know if that makes sense, but it just felt really close and intimate. Like, you didn't feel far away from it, but I don't know if that ties into what you guys were saying about the controversy, and was it going too close, and was it going too close without consent? You know what I mean? What do you think?
Mm-hmm. To me, well, as far as I understand the controversy, it's a white woman entering a space mostly of Black and Hispanic people in New York, and presenting it as something that can't be put into specific categories, like this is what reading means or whatever. Mm-hmm. Trying to define everything very clearly, put this whole setting into a box, and that kind of defeats the whole purpose of drag. There's also the whole aspect of Jenny Livingston editing out any female performers and only focusing on male, like, drag queens, female presenting while they're performing, which is something that Jasmine brought up, Drag Race. It's still present. Drag Race refuses to have drag kings or anyone who doesn't present as a woman when they're in drag. So it's a problem that continues. But yeah, there is certainly an intimacy. I'm pretty sure, like, back when they were making the documentary, every subject embraced Jenny Livingston and let her have this access to their lives. We see it with Dorian Corey. Dorian Corey is putting makeup for 8 hours, it seems. And she's just talking to Jenny Livingston. Dorian Corey, one of the smartest people in that documentary.
Yeah.
She has some skeletons in the closet, but we'll not talk about that.
What? Yeah. Literal skeletons.
Yeah, just Google Dorian Corey mummy. And we can talk about that later. But Dorian Corey, so many good quotes. Shade comes from reading. If you shoot an arrow real high, hooray for you. She's great. Anyways, I digress.
Oh, something to add specifically about Dorian. She talks about how there's a change in drag culture itself, how it's moving away from sort of extravaganza, elegance, opulence to more like looking more and more like a model and looking more and more like a woman. And that's something that I, even when I was watching Drag Race, that was also a problem in Drag Race. Like, all these older drag queens felt very edged out because all these new girls were coming in and they were winning because they were, well, the term is problematic, I learned, but fishing, or aka looking like a real woman. We don't use that term anymore, but, you know, looking real, that's something that we learned in the documentary. And I thought that was just so interesting, like, the just within its own culture, it's just, it's so vibrant and changing. And, you know, I don't know, respect to the older drag queens. It's a lost art in that aspect.
Yeah.
Also, go to drag shows. Tip your local girls. And guys.
People.
Yeah, I think that the focus on change, like, came together a little bit at the end for me when they're talking about maybe like a nostalgia for what the culture of it used to be, but they said like New York isn't even the same anymore, or something along those lines that I wrote it down. But just the ever-changingness of it and how being edged out, that's a contradicting thing to what a lot of the film and the culture felt like of embrace. Like you were saying, Fernando, of they embrace like the filmmaker, but also they were embracing each other into their houses, like these chosen families. So there's some different ideas. Like, I can see how people are feeling kind of edged out or nostalgic for what used to be.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of, like, embracing being consistent through all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the ending is just beautiful. It ends with a lip-sync performance of Over the Rainbow. Mm-hmm. Moments after they say how Venus Extravaganza died, she was murdered. But, sorry, I got distracted. yeah, it's a hopeful ending, despite the sadness that comes in at the end. Venus, AIDS. It is nostalgic, and I think a big part of that is Jenny Livingston. Just trying to make a good ending. It's narrativized, but it's also just like, it's part of New York in the 80s. And yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I like the way that it ends on this note of survivance. Like, their lives are just so much heart. Thank you. The mic was moved. Their lives are just so hard, but they still find beauty in that. And that really just highlights how strong they are. And Venus's drag mother, I think Angie was her name.
Yeah.
Angie Extravaganza. I mean, when she reveals how Venus died, she goes, I miss her every day, but you know, you got to keep moving. And it's very sad, but also it's very beautiful. I think that's kind of one of the powers of the film is that it immortalizes the dead, right? I mean, Venus isn't revealed to be dead until kind of the very end, and her legacy lives on past, you know, her very short lifespan. And that's true for, I think, all of the other queens. You know, I don't know exactly who became super big after the movie, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're kind of immortalized in this short documentary, which I think is great.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think, like, pretty much everyone who starred in the film is, like, dead now.
Not everyone. Like, I think a big part of them are dead. Most of them died from AIDS. But there's still some of them alive, I think. Yeah. I remember his name, whoever talks about mopping.
Oh, yeah.
He's still alive.
Bless.
Yeah. He's an icon. Mopping. Stealing.
Stealing.
Yeah.
Love him. Love to see it.
King Pendavis, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember him. But yeah. And the song we're going to play from this, it is, if you've seen the documentary, you will recognize it. Because I think this is all they're playing. But this is Got to Be Real by Cheryl Lynn. All right, that was Got to Be Real by Cheryl Lynn. Now we are moving on to our third film of the day, which is Pink Flamingos, directed by John Waters, 1972, starring Divine, David Lockery as Raymond Marble, and Mink Stole as Connie Marble, which the plot of the movie, for those who haven't heard about it, Connie and Raymond Marble are a married couple who are trying to take Divine's title of the filthiest person alive. And that does not do the entire movie justice, I feel, that one line. There is so much happening in this film. So, yeah, what are you guys' initial thoughts, reactions to this?
Love Pink Flamingos. Pink Flamingos, nice reference. Yeah. If there's a Mount Rushmore of queer films, which is reductive, Pink Flamingos should be up there with Divine's big face up there. I love Divine. I love John Waters. Yeah.
God, yeah.
But yeah, like you said, that description does not make this film justice. This film, the tagline is an exercise in poor taste, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah.
The whole film is about the filthiest person on earth. Which is Divine, as you learn from the opening moments. John Waters narrates the opening moments, and he claims Divine to be the filthiest person on earth. If anyone doesn't know, which you should, Divine was a drag queen. She was the most famous member of John Waters' crew of weirdos, to put it nicely. Yeah. I was reading an essay yesterday where they described Divine as Liz Taylor at her most domineering, crossed with Jane Mansfield, the women of Faster, Pussycat, Kill Kill, and Godzilla.
Oh.
And I think that's the perfect description.
Yeah.
She was a character, if there's ever been a character. She's so good. If you watch anything else by Joan Waters, she's probably in it. Yeah. She's in Hairspray, the original Hairspray.
Yeah.
That movie, also incredible. But we don't need to talk about that. Female Trouble, so good.
Stick to the film.
Okay. What do you think of Pink Flamingos, Jasmine?
I thought it was very fun, but oh my God, what a challenge to watch. Obviously, that's the point. That's the point of camp. And specifically this movie, the camp is through disgust. This movie is really disgusting. It's taboo in many ways. There's an actual animal killed in a freaky sex scene.
Yeah.
It's like basically a porno in some parts. And is that scat? Is that the word? Poop eating? Poop fetish? It goes everywhere.
I don't think it's a fetish. I just think it's to prove that you can do it. Not you, like.
No, I know you're not talking to me.
It's everything that's seen as wrong by society, it's in this film. Yeah. There's murder, there's incest, there's Divine.
Yeah, I the characters of the marbles was a very funny contrast. I mean, that the main tensions between Divine and the marbles on who can be the filthier. And when you really look at it, I mean, the marbles are running like this baby ring. It's like, it's fucked up, but it's nothing compared to Divine. And they're kind of, you know, there's moments where they are meant to be more quote-unquote filthy. But then they're not. They're actually kind of conservative, despite being, like, you know, freaks in comparison to what you might see every day. Yeah. Like, there's a scene where Raymond, like, flashes this woman, and then she flashes him with her penis. And he goes, like, oh, my God, no. He runs away, and it's like, man, come on.
Well, I can be the filthiest person alive with an attitude like that. Come
exactly.
on,
man.
I also thought the bit of, like, having, like, Raymond and Connie, like, they had, like, the bright hair and their pubes were also, like, the same, like, bright color was such a funny reveal. It's like, oh, my God.
It's incredible. Yeah. Minx stole in this film. Minx stole was also part of the John Waters freaks.
Yeah.
She's still alive. I think she's coming to the Rio. Maybe she already came. Anyways, Minx stole, incredible in this film.
Yeah.
Mary Vivian Pierce, she's the mom.
Yeah.
She only wants eggs. Divine's mom lives in a, what do you call it, a playpen or something like that?
Crib.
Yeah.
The eggs.
And she only wants eggs. She keeps calling for the Eggman. Yeah. Her voice is the funniest voice ever. She's so funny.
You want to do an imitation?
I won't, but thank you. But yeah, it's so good. It goes off the rails. It is a tough watch.
Yeah.
For some people. But I think you should watch it. Everyone should watch at least one John Waters, if not all of John Waters.
Yeah. No one is doing it like John Waters is. Like, even down to, like, his, like, exploration of this, like, sort of, like, Pink Flamingos, like, look. And, like, even, like, the opening title cards, like, very 60s, like, retro diner style. And, like, all the bright, like, garish colors. And just how that all plays out, like, into the film. It's so unlike anything that anyone was doing, especially in, like, the 70s. Like, no one was freaking out like him. Like,
yeah.
God. And Cookie Mueller in this film is so good. God, I think of her performance, like, so often. I'm like, God, like, everyone is giving their all in this movie. It's just such a labor of love, but also, like, just pure filth. Like,
yeah.
It's hitting this, like, such a strange little intersection of this film, but it's really, I'm, like, unlike anything else.
And you haven't seen this, Lily, have you?
No, I haven't seen it. No, so I've seen a couple minutes of the very beginning. But, yeah. I'm going to give it another go, you guys. I'm going to give it another go. I want to be a part of whatever, like, is this a niche audience? Like, what audience is this hitting? Like, does it have a specific, like, cultish following for this exact movie, or is it just like John Waters fans?
I'd say this film has become much more than John Waters fans. Even back when it was released, I was reading yesterday, it released at the same time as Eraserhead.
Oh my gosh.
People just put it in their minds, they see Divine's face next to the Eraserhead Jack Nance poster. So yeah, I mean, the poster itself is just such a popular image, even if people don't know who Divine is, even if people have never heard of Pink Flamingos as a movie or John Waters as a filmmaker. That photo of Divine holding the gun with that like mermaid dress, it's so iconic. I would say, yeah, people who say their favorite film is Pink Flamingos are probably in the nicher side of film. Because who else is going to say they love Pink Flamingos? I mean, it's only the queers and, like, the freaks. And, yeah, sometimes they overlap. In a Venn diagram, Pink Flamingos is in the middle.
Oh, no, they're going to say it's a circle.
Oh, yeah.
The queers and the freaks. Just a joke, guys.
But it's so good.
Oh, I think I was reading even the, like, original trailer for this, like, didn't have any footage from the film, just like the reactions of like audience members who had seen it. So like just like seeing these like crazy like shocked reactions and being like, oh, go see the movie, which I think like even to format a trailer like in such an unconventional way, I think there is like queerness in that act in a way to like go against what is expected of you in such like a radical way. Like just everything about this film is, it's like the queerness is just like baked in to this movie. And I think, yeah, definitely a movie everyone should see once in their life, if only to say you've seen it and can now experience the strangeness of John Waters.
What were your guys' favorite scenes?
Oh my God. I think anything where it was just like Divine just like wandering around town was just so much fun. Just getting to see her, like, kick it on, like, the streets. It was like, yep, yeah, I'll just see her live. How about you guys?
I love when they receive, well, Divine receives a birthday gift from the Marvels. I won't spoil what the birthday gift is. You'll have to watch it for yourselves. But she, alongside her son, decide to go take revenge on the Marvels.
Oh,
and
no.
They sneak into their house. And they decide that the filthiest thing they can do is just lick everything. And Divine just says, get your saliva glands going, slimy. And she starts licking everything. It's insane. Just her delivery of slimy, it's incredible.
Great delivery. I love Divine's birthday party. Oh. Just like the most deplorable things possible. There's like a knot. Nazi in there.
Yeah.
Nazi reference. Okay, sorry. That's an inside joke with Fernando in the CITR. He always mentions a Nazi, but I did it this time. There's a Nazi. There's policemen. There's a man with his asshole prolapsing. Or not prolapsing. What's it, pulsating? Oh God, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I was playing that, the way my setup is at home, I have a huge projectioner, so that was just projected on my whole wall, and I was like, I need to close the blinds because there's a family next to me and they're gonna look over and see just a giant anus.
Yeah,
I don't want that.
I had like the same thing happen where I was like, I was watching this like while I was like cooking dinner like in my kitchen. I'm like, I hope my roommate doesn't walk past because like, what is she gonna think? This looks insane. Yeah, this is not a film to be watching on like a bus or something like that. Like, watch this in your room or in a theater. Don't watch it on the bus.
Theater, yeah.
Definitely theater, if you can find one.
Yeah, maybe Film Sock will someday play it. Yeah. If only there was someone in charge of that here.
Fernando is in charge of every film that we screen.
Yes.
By the way, just to give you context, and he still hasn't played any John Waters from what I'm aware
no,
of.
No, I have played John Waters.
Okay, you
actually, Ellen,
that.
That's not true. I played Cecil B. DeMented last year.
I stand corrected.
I have receipts. Cecil B. DeMented, not to distract from the conversation. Cecil B. DeMented is incredible. Everyone should watch it. Melanie Griffith and Cecil B. DeMented, incredible. But I digress.
Okay. Well, you can keep your job. Good job.
I think we had one last film that we are going to talk about today. And that is Tropical Malady, which is, as a reminder, playing this Thursday. So if you're interested in what we have to say, go check it out. All right. And yeah, and I have not seen this film, but I know you three have. So what do you think, Tropical Malady? What are your thoughts? What are your opinions?
Well, Peach Pong is one of my favorite directors. Love that guy. It's my first time watching this specific film. but I think it falls very much in line with a lot of his other, his over. He's very centered on eco-cinema. Just the idea of, you know, there's this Thai belief called animism, and that's kind of what happens towards the end without spoiling it. It's the idea of, like, we are all beings. Like, everything is a being. It's not humans versus the world. We are all the world. So there's a lot of sort of body transformations that happen in these films. And there's one that happens here. And I think that in of itself could be read as queer, right? Like transforming into an animal, per se. And, you know, it's a very tender, intimate film. One of his more romantic ones. He doesn't really do a whole lot of romance. And I love how subtle and small-noted the romance is. It's really told through glances, small gestures, you know, erotic, but still very intimate, very suppressed, you could say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. It's a really good film. My experience with A Pitch of Pong was Memoria, the famous ones, Memoria and Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives.
He's a
films.
Gay icon.
Gay
Uncle
icon.
Boonmi.
Uncle Boonmi.
He's not, he's straight, but.
Is there a reference to Uncle Boonmi in this film?
What part?
A character says, like, I have an uncle who can recall his past lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
What? I missed that.
Yeah.
It's great.
You should all watch Uncle Boonmi, but I digress once again. Tropical Malady. Yeah, it's divided in two parts. The first part is this kind of romance in the middle of the jungle between two men. One of them is a soldier. Mm-hmm. And the other one works at an ice factory,
yeah,
if you could call it that.
But pretends to be a soldier sometimes.
Yeah.
Dresses up as a soldier.
It's very, yeah, it's all about the glances, the occasionally touching, running into each other by chance. It's very romantic. And then the second half turns into something completely different, but it's also kind of the same. Any thoughts, Lily?
I want to hear some, like, drawing some similarities, because I think it took a bit of reflection to find, like, where these were crossing over and be like, okay, this isn't totally random. There are elements of this tale, this kind of, like, fantasy tale that's being told in the second half. There are elements of it coming through in the first. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the parallels we were drawing just to help me kind of understand.
Well, the first thing I think of is the opening scene where it's a bunch of soldiers taking pictures with a body, a naked body, presumably one of the characters. Okay, I kind of just spoiled it. It's fine. But you know, the military figure in a lot of his movies, and especially this one, it's often like he criticizes it a lot, but also like eroticizes it. I mean, the space of a military confinement encampment is like literally so homoerotic.
Yes, Beautrevai. So gay.
Beautrevai is a good example. Yukio Mishima.
Yeah.
Famous gay icon. Suppressed. Any parallels?
Yes. The jungle.
The jungle.
No, there's a constant tension in both stories that... I don't know, it's about chasing. It's about discovery of something beyond the surface. I don't want to say too much because we're playing it tomorrow. And you should all come. Thumbsuck screening, 8 p.m. 6 p.m. starting with Princess Mononoke. But I digress. yes. Anything else you want to say?
It's just so beautiful. I mean, the last like 30 minutes is quite... I saw some Letterboxd review say that it was like a spiritual experience. And that's kind of what I felt. It's like almost fully affective, extremely simple cinematography, very confined space of the jungle. I mean, the jungle itself is just, there's so much to say about it. Very liminal, very porous. You know, if you're in the jungle, you're basically back to nature and being a wild beast. The beginning starts with that quote of like, we're all wild beasts by nature. And our task as humans is to, what do you call it?
Tame,
wrangle the beast inside. I mean, it's just such a nice, beautiful metaphor that connects eco-cinema and homosexuality in really nice ways. Like the idea that you don't have to suppress your sexuality the same way, you know, the animals that roam in the jungle are totally free and civilization is just not free. That's messed up.
What a nice message. Be queer, kids.
Come out of the closet. We see you.
Whenever you're ready.
Yes, okay. Oh, my God. You have to add that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think those were our four movies for this segment. So you guys got any closing thoughts, queer films in general?
Yes, I have a closing thought. This is by no means an exhaustive list. Please go out there. Please go watch more queer cinema. There's so many good films we could have talked about and we didn't. Yeah, Gus Van Sant, some other gay people.
Gus Van Sant and amazing. Others. There's other gay people. Maybe.
I had a list. I forgot all about that. Gus Van Sant, My Own Private Idaho.
Oh.
Yeah. Carol, so who directed Carol?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cheryl Dunier?
No.
No, I'm adding onto the list. I know she didn't type.
Todd Haynes. Todd Haynes, thank you. Yes.
Oh, gay icon.
Gay icon.
Safe. That's also a good movie.
Greg Araki.
Yeah.
John Waters, of course. There's way too many for me to name. But please, go watch more queer cinema. Support queer filmmakers.
I love that. I think that's the perfect note to end off on. And thanks for choosing this topic, you guys. Like, I feel like I got to watch so many things that I hadn't even heard of. So, I love it. Yeah. I love the selection and the songs.
Yeah, this was a very, very thorough episode. Very fun.
Thank you, Fernando and Jasmine. Hope you come back soon.
And that has been The Real World. So, we will see everyone next week from 4 to 5. Bye-bye.